friend.
Okay, good. It's good to have you with us, and it should be a little different. We'll talk to you for a while, then you can talk to us. And basically, we've been looking at your book, Behold a Pale Horse. How'd you happen to write that?
Well, it started many years ago when I was in the Navy, and I got a set of orders telling me to report for training for the Office of Naval Intelligence, and I did that. I was trained specifically in Pacific Area briefings, and then I was sent for training for Naval Security and Intelligence, and then I was sent to Camp Carter in I Corps in Vietnam, where they sent me down to Da Nang to become a patrol boat captain in the harbor, and then later I was a riverboat patrol boat captain on the Takhan River near the DMZ. Our base camp was Qua Viet with the Dong Ha River Security Group, which is a branch of Naval Security and Intelligence. When I rotated back to the United States after my Vietnam tour, I was sent for 3 months on a destroyer to do an investigation for the Naval Investigating Service, and then was attached to the intelligence briefing team of the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet. What I saw there was shocking. I had not been prepared for this at all. What I discovered was that what was really happening with the government and the military was totally 100% different than what the public was being told. And I remember one night standing watch in the command center as the petty officer watch, and watching on television as we were launching bombing raids into North Vietnam, watching the president tell the American people that we had stopped all bombing raids in North Vietnam and that we weren't conducting any bombing raids in North Vietnam. And I began to have access to top secret files and operations that had occurred and were ongoing at that particular time, and operations that were planned for the future. And I was so shocked and so amazed by what I discovered that I left the Navy actually 5 years before I could have retired very comfortably on everyone's tax dollars, and began investigating all of this stuff that I had seen. And that book is the result of that 16 years of research based upon the documentation and the briefings that I participated in while a member of the Office of Naval Intelligence.
Vietnam. Do you think that we really tried to win the war? Were we just fighting a war to perhaps distract American people from what was happening here at home? Certainly, the war was not ever fought really to defeat the Vietnamese, was it?
No, not at all. In fact, all wars since World War II, if you'll notice, have never been with the so-called enemy of the United States, the Soviet Union, and then later Red China. They've always been with third world countries as sort of a surrogate war. And the Soviet Union has never fought with us, our communist China. They have fought small surrogate wars with third world nations also. And it accomplished several things. One, the war in Vietnam, and I'm talking specifically about this war and not others, was started off to accomplish several things. One, it was to, by new methods of fighting a war, in other words, sending a young man over for 1 year and rotating him back to the United States, and filling the war with minorities, was literally designed to destroy a generation of young men, some of the finest young men in this country. It was a terrible thing to do, to send someone off to fight a war. And most of the people who fought in Vietnam, despite everything that you've ever heard, were volunteers, most of them. Some, of course, were drafted and sent against their will, but most were volunteers. They volunteered because they were patriots. They thought and were told by their government that they were fighting a war for our country, and that it was in the best national interest of the United States of America to fight this war, and that it was a war against communism. In reality, it was a war to prepare officers through experimentation with new technology for their role as senior officers, and these were young officers who were getting this training, as senior officers in the new world police force, which is coming. And in fact, is our military now is functioning as the world police force at this moment. It also was intended to destroy a generation of young men who would then be disgusted with patriotism, who would be disgusted with warfare, who would turn against their country and sort of drop out, so to speak, and would not oppose what is coming. In other words, we have a generation now of young men who fought in a war who probably will not fight in the next one, according to the estimates that, the intelligentsia have made, let's say. But I think they're wrong. I think that's not going to be the case. Anyway, it also was meant to be a population control in Southeast Asia, according to the documentation that I saw, and was to protect the heroin drug trade that was coming out of the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia. And that had been traditionally the most of the world's source of heroin. Also, at the same time, the United States Navy in the South China Sea and the Gulf of Tonkin, instead of their primary mission being to support the troops on the beach in South Vietnam fighting the war, their primary number one mission was to protect and support the oil exploration drilling ships in the Gulf of Tonkin, and second was to support and protect the troops within South Vietnam. It never became a problem because we had so many ships there that, and that the North Vietnamese Navy was destroyed early in the war, so they never were a threat to the oil exploration ships.
Well, I hate to say it, but I think that you're right. I think this war was fought against America. It wasn't fought against the North Vietnamese.
Absolutely. At the same time, I might add, there was a war being fought in the United States. Project MK-ULTRA was implemented. Dr. Timothy Leary was one of the principal agents of the Central Intelligence Agency in conducting this war to destroy the credibility and the effect that the so-called hippies or flower children were having upon the adult population and upon the political process. When they became addicted to drugs, and when Dr. Timothy Leary, with all his credentials and academic accomplishments, made it legitimate to drop out and toke up, it destroyed the political process back home. It destroyed any hopes of making a quick ending to the war, because that whole generation was discredited. Everybody looks back at that as a real bad time in this country.
Well, of course, I don't think most people were able to think it through very carefully. We were given two choices: either to back the government and their no-win war, or be a traitor and pro-communist and try to get out. And they weren't very good choices. Nobody ever asked why a country the size of the United States couldn't defeat a nation the size of the state of Mississippi in 10 years of war. And, of course, the answer was, we never intended to. We didn't go there to win. We didn't go there to defeat communism. The war was aimed at the American public. Did you have anything to do with Operation Phoenix? Do you know anything about that?
I know about Operation Phoenix. I had absolutely nothing to do with it. But it was, in fact, an operation that resulted in the assassination, in fact, the cold-blooded murder of the official estimates are around 20,000. The real number is probably closer to 30 or 35,000 of the infrastructure of the young patriot leadership of South Vietnam. The American people were told eventually that Phoenix was killing off the leaders of the communist cadres, but that's not true. They actually were killing off the leadership that would have fought the communists when they came into Vietnam, and they were preparing the way for the takeover of South Vietnam by North Vietnam.
But how can a country, you know, that's supposedly, you know, so honorable, have a planned program of assassination? I've heard figures going up to 40,000 or 50,000, but it doesn't matter. Even if 10 people were assassinated and paid by the American government, how can you justify that, and how have they been able to keep that secret? I mean, that is one of the most carefully concealed secrets from the American public, Operation Phoenix.
Well, they tried to keep it secret. It's not secret anymore. It's very well documented. It's out in the open now. They tried to keep it secret because Americans aren't supposed to be assassins. We're not supposed to be murderers. We're supposed to perform honorably upon the battlefield, and we're supposed to adhere to the rules and treaties and things that we've made. But in reality, we don't really do much of that.
Well, there there's a great deal of difference between, the appearance and reality. Well, basically, I'm speaking to my audience here in Santa Cruz, a fairly sheltered group of people who probably haven't done the research and study, you know, that many patriots like you have. And so I just throw Operation Phoenix out for those of you who are listening who have never heard of it. Planned assassination, whether it was 20 or 30 or 40,000 South Vietnamese who were systematically killed on orders of the American government. And so what was it? We paid so much for each person who was killed? How did that work?
Well, it depends upon who was doing the assassinating. If it was people like Lieutenant Colonel James Bogreitz, that was his job. He was a part of that. If they were paid assassins or South Vietnamese that were hired to do the job, then they were paid, yes.
Okay, fine. Well, this is a tragic part of our history, and yet, you know, I'm sure you share with me the concern that we are moving towards a dictatorship here in America. And I know in your book, Behold a Pale Horse, you talk about the federal executive orders, which I doubt that many of our listeners have heard about. Tell us, because our people, Santa Cruz is a pretty liberal area. We call it the People's Republic. We have people who are frank Marxists on the city council, and people who are even further to the left some places on the Board of Supervisors, although we did lose one of our local left-wingers from the Board of Supervisors, and maybe things are beginning to turn around here. But can you tell our listeners a little bit about the federal executive orders that today are the law of the land in the United States?
Well, let me start a lot earlier than that. Back in in the crash of 29, there was a terrible economic disaster in this country. They call it the Great Depression. In 1933, in trying to deal with this, the United States was actually on the verge of bankruptcy. There were a lot of unemployed people. They were trying to implement a beginning of socialism in this country. Implemented a law that was passed during World War I, and it was called the Trading with the Enemies Act. It was determined that they could use this to fight the economic war, that it didn't have to be a shooting war, it could be any kind of a war or any kind of a national emergency. So they implemented by executive order the Trading with the Enemies Act in 1933. Which literally put the United States and its citizens under emergency rule, which means the Constitution, habeas corpus, things like that are suspended. Now, they didn't tell the people that. And in the law, it specifically exempted the American people as being the enemy. In 1937, they reissued the executive order again, only this time they left out that passage and the American people became the enemy. Now, we've been living under that declaration of emergency ever since then. So the concept that anyone in this country is protected by the Constitution today, or has been since 1933, is erroneous. It's false. And that's why they've been able to do many of the things that we've questioned. Like, how can they do that? That's against the Constitution. Obviously, that's against the Constitution. That's illegal. But they're doing things all the time, constantly, that tell us that the Constitution is no longer in force. Now, later, in 1945, Harry Truman signed the United Nations Treaty. It was ratified by the Senate, and they pushed through Congress, and Harry Truman signed the United Nations Participation Act. They immediately pushed through and signed the National Security Act of 1947, and created a veil of secrecy behind which they could operate to bring power into the hands of the United Nations and destroy the sovereignty of all the nations of the world. The Cold War was actually a manipulation of the people of the world to give them a fake enemy to pretend, so that the government could pretend that the reason that they were doing all the things that they were doing and building the military forces and developing the technology that they were developing was to fight this supposed enemy, this ideological enemy of the Soviet Union. And they were doing the same thing in the Soviet Union, telling the people there that we were their enemy. In reality, this had all been agreed on by the Big Three when they met several times during World War II. And during these meetings, by the way, the reason why after World War II there was never another big war, and all wars were surrogate wars fought in third world nations, the agreement was, according to the documentation that I saw when I was with the Office of Naval Intelligence, that for population control, to keep the attention of the public away from what was really happening, which was bringing about a one-world government, a totalitarian socialist world government, the destruction of sovereign nations, that they would fight these surrogate wars, and there would be no winner of any of these wars. And if you look since that time, no one has won any wars, and no one has gained any territory through fighting of these wars. When Kennedy became president, he signed the first executive order creating what's called FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. It was put into place to take over local, state, and federal government in case, and this is the way it was worded, in case of invasion by a foreign power or nuclear attack upon the United States. Knock it off. Got my daughter and her dog in the studio playing here.
That's okay.
He signed this executive order. This created the Federal Emergency Management Agency. They also began back in the 50s creating underground, literally cities all across the country. There are these underground cities that have their own water supply and everything. They're in under a mountain in Virginia. There's a place called Mount Weather where they even have a government in waiting. They have a president there, which has not been elected. They have a full cabinet there. They have departments of all of the government agencies in the United States down there waiting in this place called Mount Weather. And they also have a computer data bank with a master warrant list where they're collecting the names and addresses of known patriots and patriot leaders who will fight the overthrow of the Constitution overtly, and the absorption of the United States overtly into the United Nations, and the transfer of power of our armed forces to the United Nations, making them, in effect, a world police force along with the military forces of what used to be called the Soviet Union. Later on, Nixon elaborated on these executive orders. He changed them around, took out invasion by a foreign country or attack by a nuclear weapon. And it's worded very curiously now, and then Reagan changed it, but now the wording says, in case of internal unrest or economic instability.
Of course, they can generate that at any time they want to.
That's right.
Just by machinations of the Federal Reserve Board.
That's correct.
Financial crisis, or, in fact, I have really seriously wondered if some of the patriotic leaders that are going around now may very well be creating fear and getting people to organize just to create the sort of crisis that could justify the implementation of dictatorship. Do you sense that?
Well, I don't think that so. I think that there are some patriot leaders who are not patriot leaders who are trying to identify those patriots who will resist the destruction of the sovereignty of the United States by force of arms if necessary to restore the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to their legal and lawful place as the supreme law of the land. I know that there's going to be in this country, if they don't back away from this encroaching socialism, if they don't return the Constitution, the Bill of Rights to their lawful and legal place as the supreme law of the land, there will be civil war in this country to do it. There are men who will not go into give up what so many people have lived and died for to put together. The United States of America. Most Americans don't even understand that until the Constitution and the Bill of Rights were penned by our forefathers, that no people on this earth had ever been truly free until that time, and even since that time, we're the only people on the face of this earth who have truly been kings and queens in our own right, and have had the rights and the protections of those rights in the history of the world. And right now, today, all of the protection of the rights guaranteed us under the Bill of Rights of the first 10 amendments have been stripped away. Some of the rights in the 7 articles of the Constitution we have lost. Now, most Americans don't understand this and don't know it because most Americans, unfortunately, aren't really Americans and have never read the Constitution, don't know what it says. And if they did read it in their life, it usually was in a high school class when they had little Susie or little Johnny on their mind, and they really didn't care much about what they were reading.
Of course, the the teacher would interpret it for them and tell them the First Amendment was the wall of separation between church and state.
Well, the truth is, there is no separation between church and state. Our forefathers put an article in the Constitution which forbade the government from respecting any institution of religion.
Of course, you know, but the funniest thing is, you ask the average person where the wall of separation occurs, and they will invariably tell you it's in the First Amendment. That's because they never read the First Amendment.
Yeah, the First Amendment says that the government has to keep their hands off religion. They cannot pass any legislation or laws respecting any institution of religion, period. That's all it says. It doesn't say that you can't be religious. It doesn't say you can't say prayers in school. It does, in fact, it was never meant for our schools to be run by the government. Then that's the truth on that matter.
Sir, in fact, at the time the First Amendment was passed, all but one of the 13 colonies had a state religion. Religion was a matter that would be left to the states and to the people, not to the federal government, and there was never any intention of preventing the Bible or Christianity from being espoused in schools. Everybody knew this was a Christian country for many years until recently, when 1962, the Supreme Court, which obviously had a certain prejudice, simply without any legal precedent, without any justification other than the testimony of a psychologist, said, well, you know, there is a wall of separation. Do you mind taking a call here? We have somebody on the line who wants to talk to you about Iron Mountain.
No, go ahead.
Okay, hi, Ben. Are you there?
Hey, I had to run to the phone. Yeah, Bill, what's happening? I met you at the preparedness meeting in San Jose, at the convention center. But I've been keeping track of a lot of your information, and it's pretty much right on the money. And there's something else that needs to be talked about yet, or maybe you have, I just tuned in. And that's the either phony or real alien threats they're concocting to galvanize the New World Order.
All right, you want to cover that at all, Bill?
Phony are real threats that they're concocting to galvanize the New World Order.
The aliens, the UFO bit.
Well, it's not just that. It's a lot of things. They have a lot of concurrent plans operating on us all the time. For instance, this global warming thing is not real. The ozone holes are not real. The UFOs could be an operation to create an artificial enemy from space in order to justify asking all the peoples of the world to drop their national sovereignty and come together in a one-world government so that we could face this threat together. All of these things were outlined in a plan called the Report from Iron Mountain, which surfaced about 1966. Supposedly Kennedy had ordered this study done, and it took several years to do it. It was done in secret. The first meeting was held in a repository of corporate records called Iron Mountain, and then they had meetings all over the place for the next several years. They put together a report. The purpose of the meetings and the study was to study the possibility and probability of permanent peace, and what would be the necessary ingredients to make it happen, and what would have to occur to make it last. So one of the first thing that they arrived at, the first conclusion they arrived at, that all economies in the world were based upon a war economy. In other words, nations and governments existed and they were held together, and their economy worked because they had a common enemy somewhere. And throughout history, if you look, it's basically been true. I don't think it's necessarily true today, but nevertheless, that was the conclusion of the report from Iron Mountain, that there had to be an enemy. Now, only way you could do away with war is if you had an enemy that could replace war but did not require the killing of people. For instance, an environmental war, intentionally and purposely polluting the environment to create a state of tension and worry and foreseeable disaster in the future for which you could mobilize all people to pull together and see the common enemy and want to work to address that environmental hazard. And for many years, the large corporations who belong to these organizations, who make these plans and bring them about, were dumping large amounts of of pollution and hazardous chemicals and waste material into lakes and rivers and streams and into the atmosphere. It was done intentionally. It wasn't an accident. And it brought about the desired result. It did mobilize people. And a lot of those environmental concerns are real. But the point I want to make is that some of them were done by greedy people who wanted to make a quick buck, but a lot of it was done by major corporations who are part of this plan trying to bring about a one-world government, and it was done intentionally. Things were created that are fiction, imaginary things. For instance, the ozone hoax, as I like to call it. There is no layer of ozone around the Earth. Ozone occurs throughout the atmosphere. Ozone is created and destroyed every single second, simply because ozone is a radical molecule. It's made from two molecules of oxygen splitting, making four ions of oxygen, or four ion atoms that are independently floating around looking for something to attach to. One of them will attach to an oxygen molecule, which is O2, already has two atoms of oxygen, making it O3, which is a radical molecule. In other words, it's looking for something to oxidize instantly. And the minute that it finds something that will oxidize, this third atom of oxygen breaks loose from the O2, and it does exactly that. Now, they say that ozone is protecting us from the ultraviolet rays of the sunlight, and that's the biggest fantasy and fiction that's ever been created. The truth is that ozone is created by ultraviolet light coming from the sun. It comes into the atmosphere until it reaches a zone or an area in the upper atmosphere where the concentration of oxygen molecules are such that it begins to strike oxygen molecules at a rapid rate. This causes a chemical reaction which depletes the energy in the ultraviolet light rays, and it splits the oxygen molecules, causing these two atoms, now free from each other, to seek out something to attach to. When they bump into another molecule of oxygen, they attach, and that creates ozone. So ozone doesn't protect us from ultraviolet light. Ozone is created by ultraviolet light coming into the atmosphere. And if it were not for this happening, if ozone were not created by ultraviolet light, then we would be in danger of being burnt to a crisp by ozone. The truth is, as long as there's oxygen in the atmosphere, and as long as there's ultraviolet light coming from the sun, there will be plenty of ozone in our atmosphere, and we don't have to worry about it. We don't produce enough CFCs to even make a dent in the ozone in any portion of the atmosphere. One volcanic eruption in one day will deplete more ozone in the atmosphere than the entire history of the human race has ever done.
Well, the other thing they never mentioned is that the fluorocarbons are actually heavier than air, so they don't go up in the atmosphere.
That's right. They never get up that high.
But they just never bring this out.
Yeah. Also, you might want to ask people when they talk about this ozone hole baloney. I'd say something else, but I don't want to shock anybody out there. When they talk about this ozone baloney, that if their assertions were true, if their allegations were true, the ozone hole would be over New York City, would be over Los Angeles, would be over Tokyo, would be over London. It wouldn't be over the South Pole. When there's winter at the South Pole.
There's not very many people using hairsprays down in the South Pole.
That's right. The truth is, the ozone holes occur over the poles only when that pole is experiencing winter at the pole, because the Earth is tilted on its axis. No sunlight is striking that portion of the atmosphere over that pole in the winter. They have 6 months of darkness. Therefore, the chemical reaction does not take place. Ozone is not created, and you get these photographs of supposed holes.
Okay, Ben, any other questions?
Yes, there's something I wanted to point out that a lot of people didn't really take notice to. You know, I find it was funny. One friend of mine, an ex-Special Forces, he was an ex-F in the Army, noticed this on the news. It was when they released that serial rapist up in Oregon, the camp that they showed that he was staying in, the concentration camp on the outside, and it was, the sprawling behavioral modification facility that he was aware of that they have all over the United States. And he noticed that they showed this on TV. It was like a mistake. They weren't supposed to show the sign or something. And he noticed it, and I noticed it.
Well, I didn't see it, so...
yeah, it was on the news when they showed the camp that the serial rapists. Remember the news?
Sure. Okay, fine. Well, thanks so much, Mr. Ben.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
But just for the listener here, this book, The Report from Iron Mountain, I can remember in 1966 or 67 when it came out, and it has been reprinted. And one of the things it said, you know, other than over and above what Bill Cooper's already told you, was, well, look, if we have to, we'll contaminate the entire planet, but we need to have this enemy, the environmental threat. That's how we're going to control the people. And you see this thing unfolding, you know, regularly, whether it's in Rio or where it is, and all sorts of scientists, for instance, the Heidelberg Memorandum, signed by, you know, 100 or so Nobel laureates, said this whole environmental movement is a scam. But you never saw that on controlled CBS, ABC, or NBC.
That's correct.
Let's go ahead and talk to Tony here. Hi, Tony.
Yeah, hi, Doctor. Hi, Mr. Cooper.
Hello.
I read your book, and I wanted to update on that Jonathan Main fellow, if you had anything new on him. And I thought it was a very interesting story, and I was kind of wondering, like, what happened to the property he had.
I have no idea. He was released from prison about a year ago, and from what I understand, he's not the same person. I don't know what they did to him, but he's just not the same person.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about it, because I don't know the story.
Well, he was he understood that what was happening to our economy and our money system. He was from England. He had developed a method of using his own personal wealth to purchase large amounts of undeveloped land that contained, by proof, by exploration, X amount of tons of natural resources of gold, silver, bank and still backed by silver or gold. A bank backed by the natural resources that the bank would then have backing its currency. It would then issue a different kind of money. They would be credit vouchers, in effect, that would be backed by real wealth. These natural resources that had not been reclaimed or taken out of the ground or cut down and made into paper or whatever. And that way, they could get out from under the debt system that everyone is being subjected to now. For instance, our money used to be backed by gold and silver coin. In fact, our money, by law, is called a dollar. A dollar is defined by law as a specific weight of measurement, or specific measurement of weight of gold or silver coin. A dollar is really currency only as long as it can be exchanged for gold or silver coin, which is the real money of the United States of America. The debasement of our coinage, by the way, the penalty of which is death if you're convicted of debasement of our money. And the money defined by law, by the Constitution, is gold and silver coin, nothing else. Now, if you have gold and silver coin, you can issue silver certificates and gold certificates as long as whoever holds them can turn them into any bank or to the government and receive that much of weight of gold or silver in coin of the realm at any time they so desire. But gold, ownership of gold was made illegal back in the 30s. It was taken away from the American people when they implemented the Trading with the Enemies Act. Later, gold certificates disappeared. Then they withdrew silver coins and began minting what we call copper clad. And they put a little layer of silver alloy on the outside of these copper coins so that the sheeple, the stupid people, would think that they still had the same value in their hand when they had these coins. The fact is, they were debased, and they were worth no more than the copper content in the coins. And then they took away the silver certificates and began issuing Federal Reserve notes. Federal Reserve notes will be the death of this nation economically, simply because it is a method of constant and consistent inflation through borrowing non-existent money, which is created by a bookkeeping entry. When that happens, the Federal Reserve asks the Treasury to print up the bills. they've just created by a bookkeeping entry. Bear in mind now, the Federal Reserve is a private corporation, not an actual agency of the United States government. So when they did that and created this phony money and had the Treasury Department print this money, they paid exactly what it cost to print the money. The Treasury Department did not make a penny. They then take this money and buy a United States Treasury bond with this money that's interest-bearing. So our government now has this money they created out of thin air. Our government gives them a Treasury bond, which is interest-bearing. This money then goes out into circulation into the country through the government paying its bills and paying the salaries of the people who work for the government. And then we, the American people, have to pay this money back that never existed through real wealth, the creation of substance through our work, the sweat of our brow. And then, not only that, but we have to pay back the interest, which was never created in the first place, guaranteeing that we get poorer and poorer every year, and that the value of the dollar shrinks every year. For the last 40 years, we've gone from a dollar value of 100 cents down to approximately 10 cents today. It's probably closer to 8 cents, but I won't quibble over a couple of pennies because it's the stupidity of allowing this to happen that is the real thing we need to understand about ourselves.
And so every dollar that is actually out in circulation, we have to pay interest, and we pay it to the bankers who own the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve is a privately owned central bank.
That's right. And the Internal Revenue Service is the collection agency for the Federal Reserve. When you write a check to pay your taxes, your income tax, if you're a taxpayer, when that check comes back to you, when it's gone through and you've paid your taxes and it comes back and you get it from your bank, if you'll turn it over and look on the back of the check, you'll see that it was not deposited to the account of the Treasury of the United States of America. Instead, it says, pay to the order of any Federal Reserve Bank in payment of United States obligations. So the money that you pay in income taxes doesn't even go into the United States Treasury. The Treasury gets its money from other things, from excise taxes, gasoline taxes, import-export taxes, things of that nature, which, by the way, are legal taxes, income taxes not.
Right. And, you know, I heard about this fellow. He'd go into a restaurant, and when the bill would come, he'd say to the waitress, can I pay this bill with Federal Reserve notes? And the waitress would look a little surprised, and she'd go over and get the manager, and the manager would say, you want to pay this with Federal Reserve notes? What are they? And I think every person should do this, because what we need to do is let the American people come to realize that somebody has stolen our monetary system. They have done it by a very careful and deceitful manner. The Federal Reserve is no more an agency of the federal government than a Federal Express is, and we are enslaved by an organized effort to control the banking and ultimately the currency of this nation. We've been taken over, fellas, and they create wars for their purposes, for their profit, and their ultimate goal is the new one world order.
Well, that's correct, and I'll go you one better than that. Ever since we've been using Federal Reserve notes, they have literally taken over the nation, and we have become indentured servants. You see, when you operate on a debt system like that, you are not paying your debts. If you go down and buy a car with Federal Reserve notes, you've committed an illegal act if you actually think that you own that car. And if you try to own it, it's illegal. The truth is you cannot purchase something or pay a debt with an instrument of debt. A Federal Reserve note is nothing more than a note. A note is an instrument of debt. It says somebody owes somebody some money, and it hasn't been paid yet. So you're taking that instrument of debt down, and you're using it to purchase something or buy something or pay a debt. You cannot pay a debt with another debt. You cannot purchase something with a debt that hasn't been paid. And that's when Americans began receiving warrant deeds to their homes and to their land instead of allodial patent titles, which really means that you own it. If you receive a warrant deed, it warrants that a deed exists, but you don't have it. The true owner has it, and you have to pay a property tax, which is a rental on that property that the true owner actually owns. It applies to other things, too. For instance, you no longer get a title to your automobile, or to anything else that you purchase with Federal Reserve notes, you receive a certificate of title, which certifies that a title exists, but again, you don't have it. The state has it because the state owns that property until the debt is paid. In other words, we have now become indentured servants for the debt of the United States of America because this money has been created out of thin air and the interest is never created, thus making it impossible to ever pay the debt. People are talking about balancing the budget, paying the debt. It cannot be done. The currency does not exist. It is possible if you pay off your land or your property in gold or silver coin and then pursue a process through the courts. You can do it, yes.
Last question. I'll hang up and take hands on here. Could you give a little update on what's happening in Arizona with the Brady Bill and the sheriff?
The sheriff in Arizona is not going to enforce the Brady Bill. It's unconstitutional. It's unconstitutional according to the Constitution of the state of Arizona. It's unconstitutional according to the Constitution of the United States. The second article in amendment says that a militia being necessary to a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The law also specifically states that the militia is not the National Guard and it is not the military. The militia, the unorganized militia, consists of the whole people, and specifically in the law, it specifically states all male citizens between the age of 17 and 45. Therefore, it is against the law, against the Constitution of both the federal and the state government to take weapons away from anyone who constitutes the militia.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because there is a massive program, as you well know, to take the guns away from the public. I, last weekend, was at the meeting of the California Medical Association, and those of you who are out there will be happy to know that the California Medical Association House of Delegates voted that everybody who has a gun or ammunition or uses a gun has to have a license, and the doctors and representatives voted for that. This is the path to dictatorship, and when I got up and made a statement to that effect, there were so many of the audience just sort of scoffed, but they're, you know, they're doctors there who are 30 or 40 years old who have gotten into the House of Delegates of the CMA so they can use the policy and the political power and the lobbying efforts which are generated by doctors paying dues to the CMA to bring about the dictatorship in America. And the average person in America has no idea the new crime bill is aimed to take to totally abridge the Second Amendment and take away the guns from the people as a prelude to the establishment of the dictatorship of the New World Order. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And these people, these PhDs, these doctors, these university professors, these so-called intellectuals who are promoting Marxism and socialism aren't as intelligent or smart as they think they are. If they were, they would go back and study history. And if they studied history, they would find that whenever socialism comes to power, the first people that socialism destroys and places in labor camps or outright executes are the intelligentsia, the university professors, the lawyers, the PhDs, all of the people who promoted Marxism and socialism and brought them into power are the first people that they throw into the labor camps are completely 100% exterminate. Simply because they're the people who, once they see socialism actually at work on them, will be the first people to turn against it.
I agree. But I think that the American people must understand that what is happening is a carefully planned program. In fact, I was watching television this evening, and they had this black and white sequence with these children with the sad faces. They were making remarks and sort of a hopeless feeling, and then the caption at the end was, "We must stop the violence." Well, the basic theme is we're going to take the guns away from the law-abiding citizens and stop the violence? No way. I mean, all the places where they've taken the guns away from the people, New York and Washington, D.C., they've got crime rates 3 or 4 times that of the surrounding areas.
Every place that has laws saying that the populace cannot own weapons has the highest murder rate in the country. They have the highest crime rate in the country. Like I told you, these so-called intellectuals aren't smart. You can be intellectual and not be smart. My grandmother used to tell me that you can have all the degrees in the world, but if you don't have 1 ounce of common sense, what good does it do you?
Well, I think that these people have an agenda. And you know,
absolutely. They're Marxists. They really believe that they're going to make the world better by taking freedom and rights away from people and putting them in shackles so that they can control them every second of their life. They don't understand that they're also going to be in those shackles.
They think they're going to be the leaders.
Well,
Solzhenitsyn started out as a socialist, a hardline socialist, and it wasn't until he got to the gulag that he suddenly did an about-face and became, you know, returned to God, and suddenly realized that the horror that he and the other idealists had created, believing that man be able to create a better society.
Sure. They lionize Stalin, and Stalin is the greatest murderer in the history of the world. Conservatively, he killed 40 million people, and that's conservative figures. He probably killed many, many more million than that.
For the people here in Santa Cruz, I want you to know I got an invitation this last week to a meeting of the Communist Party. Mr. Bill Wood invited me to a meeting over on the west side, just off of Mission Avenue on Saturday afternoon, and told me that, of course, they did this because I think the People's Daily World, or People's Weekly World, I guess it is now, and they had my name on a mailing list, so I got this nice personalized invitation. The head of the Northern California chapter of the Communist Party was going to be there, and you know, all the local communists are going to be there. People think we don't have communists. Of course we have communists, and we have socialists, and we have Marxists. In fact, we probably have more Marxists here, you know, at the University of California here in Santa Cruz than they have in Moscow. And the people in Moscow don't really believe in this. People up here at UC do. That's the tragedy. There and in Washington, D.C.
Well, sometimes you got to experience it to understand what it is. Me, all I got to do is read about history and what they've done in history, and I don't have to experience one bit of it, and I'm not going to, as long as I'm able to fight. Me and many, many other people in this country will fight to our death before we will allow it.
Well, I think one of the hardest things for the average citizen to understand is that many of the people who are pushing Marxism the hardest are the people of great wealth and great influence and the great foundations of America, Rockefeller Found, Carnegie, Ford, Fund the Republic. And it is these foundations, these people of great wealth, who believe, you know, that this concentration of power is going to be in their hands.
Well, that's what they believe, but, you know, Stalin would teach them different. Mao Zedong would teach them different. Fidel Castro would teach them different. Hitler would teach them different. By the way, Hitler was a socialist, and we might as well square that up right away. Everybody out there talks about the left and the right and the extreme left and extreme right, and they always put Nazis on the right. And that is an illusion, a delusion. It's a fantasy. It's not true. Nazis are on the left. Nazis were socialists. National socialism is just a little bit above communism. They are both on the left. Communism is extreme left. Nazis, national socialism is just a little above communism. A republic is somewhere toward the middle. Extreme right wing is total anarchy. It's no control over anyone. And they're putting out these deceptions so people will think that there's something wrong with the right wing. The right wing people actually want more freedom for everyone. Extreme right wing or anarchy is just as bad as extreme left wing or communism. But there are no Nazis in the right wing, I guarantee you. It's a deception because the New World Order will be something along the lines of what Hitler planned.
I'm sure you're right. Well, we've only got about a minute here before we have to break for the news. What are we going to do the next hour?
Well, I'm gonna. While you're breaking for the news, I'm going to link up on the satellite and get ready for our broadcast.
Right.
And I'll have my daughter here. Now, I won't be able to take calls during my broadcast, but we'll be able to take calls from your listeners. My 3.5-year-old daughter is going to be helping me with this broadcast tonight. We'll be going worldwide by satellite and shortwave.
All right, very good. So we'll break off here, and I'll just put you on hold, and we'll be back right at the right on the hour.
Okay.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And this is Dr. Stan here.